Okay, so let's have a look at this for Mara's presentation. Now, normally the for Mara's presentation is a way of describing what things we need to overcome to simply achieve the goal of nirvana. And that's how I'm going to present it here, although we can also talk about the four Maras, which we need to overcome to achieve enlightenment, which are just a little bit more subtle form of the things I'm going to describe now. But to keep it simple, we'll use the most common presentation of the four Maras that obstruct achieving the goal of nirvana. So remember, usually we say that what is obstructing us achieving the goal of nirvana is these afflictive obscurations, which is basically our mental afflictions. Which in Sanskrit is our kleshas. Then also we can talk about the Mara of the aggregates. Which in Sanskrit is the skandhas. We're going to look at this in some detail shortly. There's a presentation called the five aggregates. But here we can simply talk about, to simplify it, we can talk about the body and the mind that we have now. Of course, the body and the mind we have now is contaminated. We have a contaminated mind, and the body that we have is produced through these causes and conditions. Then, of course, we can talk about the Mara of death itself, which in Sanskrit is the Marana. And the fourth Mara can be described as sensory attachment. And this in Sanskrit actually is Devaputra Mara. And usually Devaputra Mara was sort of externalized, saying that there was this sort of being called Devaputra who sort of shot these arrows into you. And these arrows caused you to have these mental afflictions such as attachment and aversion and jealousy. So usually in that four Mara's presentation, it was externalized. But I think really what this is symbolic is of the main thing is our sensory attachment, that this is our driving force in our life, that we're craving and having attachment to all the sense pleasures. So these are the four Maras that we need to overcome if we are to really achieve the goal of nirvana. We need to overcome the mental afflictions and, of course, the contaminated body and the mind that is produced through that. We need to, of course, overcome the cycle of birth, aging, death, and in a practical sense, we need to overcome this sensory attachment that is often described as actually the source of our suffering in the Theravada tradition. And there are a sort of a more subtle variations of this in terms of enlightenment, but I think we won't go into that because it's not so relevant here. In terms of enlightenment, I think the presentation that can be more helpful is the two obscurations presentation, which we're going to look at in quite some detail in the coming days. Okay. So this is how the term Bhagavan is defined. Is there any questions on this, by the way? But here in the text,
instead of Bhagavan, we see Bhagavati. So the ti is a feminine particle. So why do we have the feminine particle here? The reason is that we said that there are two aspects to the path. There is the prajna and upaya, or the method and the wisdom, or wisdom and compassion. And each of those aspects is sort of related to as the feminine masculine. Now, you would think maybe that it should be compassion the feminine and wisdom masculine, but actually it's the other way in Buddhism. And the reason being is that, and it goes back to, well, it's just in terms of relating that to everyday life, is that it's wisdom, it's this wisdom of emptiness that literally gives birth to Arya beings. So it's, of course, the women who give birth to children. And it's the wisdom of emptiness that gives birth to Arya Bodhisattvas and Arya Buddhas. So that's why wisdom is considered feminine, because of that reason, giving birth to Arya beings and enlightened beings. And method is masculine, because, at least historically, it was the father of the family who would determine what the child, particularly the son, what vocation, what job they would pass on to them. So it was the masculine side of the family that would determine the father is a carpenter, so the son is going to be the carpenter or the plumber or whatever. And similarly here, the method side is how we engage in the spiritual path. What way do we follow the spiritual path? And so here we already talked about these the three lineages already. So remember, we talked about the three lineages, the three different ways of approaching the spiritual path. We talked about the Shravaka lineage, which usually is translated as the hearer's lineage. So this is someone who would follow the spiritual path by constantly relying on instructions from the teacher. Then a slight variation to that was called the was the Pratyekya Buddha approach to practice, which often is translated into English as solitary realizer. So this is someone who, at least towards the end of the spiritual path, sort of goes off on their own to manifest the result. They may hear a little bit of instruction at the beginning, but then they really are more going to isolation to progress in the spiritual path. And then the other approach to practice was the Bodhisattva lineage. So both of these approaches to practice have as their goal nirvana. Even though this is called Pratyeka Buddha, it's not really mean that we're going to become fully enlightened. Whereas this lineage of practice, of course, the goal is enlightenment. And this three lineages come up a little bit later in the Heart Sutra. So these different approaches to practice, these lineages, parallel, historically at least, the lineage of jobs that the children would have depending on the father's lineage. So hence, this is the masculine side, the upaya side, the method side. So that's why we have, for example, you know, in the meditation posture, we have wisdom as the left side and method is the right side. So we have the left hand is the wisdom, the right hand is the compassion, and the fact that the thumbs are touching is that we need to combine them, we mean to balance them. So that's why we have here the feminine particle, the TI particle, to signify that what we're really talking about here is the wisdom aspect of the practice. That this wisdom of emptiness is going to give birth to here, particularly Arya Bhagavan, an Arya Buddha, enlightened being. So this is basically the title of the text, Arya Bhagavati Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, meaning it's the sutra, of course, is the discourse of the Buddha. And so this discourse or sutra is the essence, the Hridaya, of all of the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom teachings, and that this text describes the subject matter of emptiness. And by realizing that emptiness supported by bodhicitta, we will become an Arya Bhagavan. So this is the title of the text. So let's now then have a look at the first part of the text. Now we see that we can divide the Heart Sutra initially into two sections. The first section, it says, the prologue indicating the origination of the sutra, and the second section is the subject matter of the actual sutra. So the first part of the sutra is what's called the prologue. The prologue is like the setting, describing the setting of the sutra. And within that setting, the prologue, we can divide that into two parts, the common prologue and the uncommon prologue. The common prologue is something in common to all sutras, that all sutras begin in this way, that they begin describing a few things at the beginning of the sutra. So this is something in common to other sutras. Whereas the uncommon prologue is describing what is unique to this sutra. What is the unique part of the setting of this sutra is in the uncommon prologue. So let's have a look at the common prologue. And the common prologue describes basically four elements in terms of the setting of the sutra. And these are often called the four perfect conditions. So the first part of the setting is the time. Meaning, when did this sutra, this discourse take place? And that is in the first sentence when it says, thus did I hear at one time. Now, of course, when we look at that sentence, we can say, well, who is this I here? Who's this person that says, thus did I hear at one time? And actually, there's a lot of discussion about this, about who this I here is. Who is the person who is later recounting basically what they heard? And there are a number of different assertions. But the most common assertion as to who this I is that it is Ananda. Ananda is the personal attendant of the Buddha. And it's said that Ananda had this thing called stream of Dharma. It's a particular type of concentration which enables the ability to memorize a lot of things, texts and things that they hear perfectly. And this is something that can be developed through the shamatha practice, the concentration practice. we can develop this ability for this perfect memory. And for example, one great Indian master, Vasubandhu, who was instrumental in the Sautrantika system, it said that he had memorized 900 texts, as an example. So it said that Ananda had this capacity. And it said, thus did I hear at one time. Even the two words one time can be interpreted in a number of ways. But the most common one is that one time means simply that this teaching only took place once, that the Buddha only gave this instruction once. And again, when did the Buddha give this teaching in his 45 years of teachings? A lot of discussion about that. It's not so clear. One assertion is roughly about 20 years after enlightenment. But again, it's only one of many assertions. So that's what this time means. Time means when did the sutra, this discourse take place? And that is, thus did I hear at one time. Then the second part of the condition is the teacher. Who is the teacher here? And then that is the next two words, the Bhagavan. So again, the Bhagavan, again, whenever we see the word Bhagavan in Buddhist scriptures, it's always referring to Shakyamuni Buddha. Sometimes in the text also you'll see the word the teacher. And also the teacher usually is referring to Shakyamuni Buddha. And there are a number of different terms used to describe the Buddha. And each one has a slightly different perspective. Another one that comes up later in the Heart Sutra is Tathagata. This is another word for the Buddha. There's also Sugata, many different terms used to describe an enlightened being, the Buddha. Each one sort of describing some from the Buddha from a slightly different perspective. So the Bhagavan here is the teacher. And the third of the four perfect conditions is, where did this sutra take place? The location. And the location is, it says, was dwelling on Mass of Vultures Mountain in Rajgir. So that's where it took place. Rajgir literally means the place of the king or the residence of the king. So Rajgir was actually the capital of the whole region. And the king at the time was King Bimbisara. And King Bimbisara was actually a disciple of the Buddha, and he appears in a number of different sutras. And we'll come, and he's relevant a little bit later in the Heart Sutra. King Bimbisara also has some relevance later when we're talking in the Heart Sutra. And it says here that he was dwelling on Mass of Vultures Mountain. Sometimes that's called Vultures Peak, but it's basically just a very small hill outside of Rajgir, the town. And that's where the Buddha was mainly, and he spent a lot of time there before and after enlightenment. Prince Siddhartha, when he was on his quest for enlightenment, also spent quite a lot of time around there at Vultures Peak, around Rajgir, and also after enlightenment spent a lot of time teaching in that area. And this is where most of these Perfection of Wisdom Sutras teachings took place, the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. Now, why it's called Mass of Vultures Mountain or Vultures Peak, again, there are many different assertions as to why this little hill is called Vultures Peak. One assertion is that it looks like the head of a vulture. I mean, I've been there many times, but I can't pick that. Another assertion is that at the time of the teaching, there was a lot of vultures circling. And then I think there's one or two other interpretations, but again, what the real reason, maybe not so clear. So that's the place. It took place on the top of this little hill called Vultures Peak, just outside the main town Rajgir, the king's residence, which is he was the king of the whole central region called Magadha. So that's the location.
And then the fourth point is who was present, who was actually there at the time. The audience.
So in the audience it says here there was that he was dwelling there together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. So here what's been translated as community is Sanskrit word sangha, spiritual community. So it's said here there was a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And usually the word great implies not only in number, but in quality as well, but generally in number. So it's said that there was a large number of monks and a large number of bodhisattvas present in this teaching. And then probably a number of you have been to this Vulture's Peak, and it's quite small on the top, so how all these... In fact, I think we're talking like more than 1,000 people in presence. How they fit on there, it's a little bit difficult to understand. But anyway, they said there was a large number of monks and bodhisattvas present at this teaching. So this is the common prologue, meaning that sutras normally begin in this way, to describe the time, the teacher, the location, and who's present during this discourse. Then we'll look at now the uncommon prologue, which is describing what is unique to this particular sutra, what is unique about the setting of this sutra. And so here we have, it says, at that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. So again, the Bhagavan is Shakyamuni Buddha. And it says he was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. So there are many ways of categorizing phenomena. Oh, and by the way, here, phenomena is a translation of the Sanskrit word dharma. So the Sanskrit word dharma... can have many meanings. In fact, one text I studied, I think was from Vasubandhu, he listed 10 meanings of the word dharma. Generally, of course, in Buddhist texts, when we see the word dharma, we're talking about the teachings of the Buddha. And when we're talking about the teachings of the Buddha, we can talk about that in two ways. We can talk about the actual text, the actual scriptures, but of course, when we talk about the three jewels of refuge, you know, we talk about Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and we say that the actual refuge is the Dharma, then what we're really talking about is not the actual texts. Because no matter how many texts we have, no matter how many texts we've read or studied, they themselves will not protect us from suffering. What's going to protect us from suffering is how much we've internalized these teachings, how much we've realized these teachings. So the second, when we talk about Dharma, we talk about scripture and we talk about realization. So normally when we talk about Dharma, we talk about the Dharma of scripture and the Dharma of realization. How much we've internalized these ideas, how much we've come to realize them. To that extent, we'll be protected from suffering. But of course, here, the word dharma has been translated as phenomena. So dharma can also mean simply all the things that exist are dharmas. And dharma can also have other meanings. So again, just be a little bit careful when you see that word, that not to automatically assume it means one of these two things. Now here, it talks about the categories of phenomena. Now there are many ways of categorizing phenomena, and we're going to come up with some of those, or we're going to see some of those later in the Heart Sutra, particularly at the top of page 2 here of the Heart Sutra. There's a big paragraph that says, know this, know this, know this, know this. When we get there and we look at them, we'll see that that is actually groups of categories, meaning that one way of categorizing all functional phenomena, functioning things, is what's called the five aggregates, which we're going to look at very shortly. And also in this big list of know this, know this, in the top of page 2, the second way of categorizing all functional phenomena is into what are called the 12 sources, or a bigger presentation are called the 18 elements or the 18 constituents. So these are three common ways of dividing up all functional phenomena. And we're going to look at those in some detail later because they have some relevance and importance and practical benefit of understanding them. We're going to be looking at the first of those categorizations, the five aggregates, very shortly, because they actually come up in this paragraph here that we're looking at. So basically it was saying that the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena, meaning that the Buddha was perceiving, directly absorbed in all these various categories of phenomena. But it says here the concentration he was absorbed in was profound perception. So how was he experiencing all these different categories of phenomena is in terms of profound perception. The word profound here is meaning emptiness. So often emptiness, we talk about wisdom and compassion or wisdom and method. And then often the wisdom side of the path is often called the profound path. Whereas the method side, the compassion side, is often called the vast path in terms of vast number of activities that we need to engage in. So emptiness is usually the profound, the method is the vast. So here the word profound perception is indicating that the Buddha was realizing the profound, meaning emptiness. So what this is actually saying is here is that the Buddha was not only directly perceiving all the categories of phenomena, meaning all phenomena, but he was also realizing the emptiness of all phenomena at the same time. So this is something that only an enlightened being can do, is that as an ordinary being, even as a bodhisattva on the Mahayana path, we alternate. We're either absorbed in emptiness or we are interacting in the world. We can't do them simultaneously. But when we achieve enlightenment, we can not only be in present in the world, but at the same time realizing emptiness directly. So that's what's being indicated here, that the Bhagavan was absorbed in this. He was absorbed in emptiness, but at the same time, he was aware of the whole phenomenal world. Now, probably to the audience, he appeared to be sitting there deeply absorbed into emptiness, but he was completely aware of what was going on. Then it says, also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So here there's a few important points to cover. First is, it says, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. So here already there seems to be something a little bit strange. Avalokiteshvara, of course, is the Buddha of compassion, translated into Tibetan as Chen Rezig. In fact, Avalokiteshvara, the first part of that word, Avalokita, means to look out on sentient beings. That's what Avalokita means. And what's implied in that is that to look out on sentient beings with compassion. And then the second part of that word is from the root Ishvara. And Ishvara means, sometimes translated as Lord or capable one, one that has a lot of capacity. So here, when we talk about Ishvara, in terms of Avalokiteshvara, we're talking about someone who has a lot of capacity to help dispel the sufferings of others. So Avalokiteshvara is someone who is looking out on sentient beings with compassion and has a lot of capacity to help dispel the sufferings of others. And of course it says Arya here. Now, Avalokiteshvara again is a enlightened being, is a Buddha, the Buddha of compassion, Chenrezig in Tibetan. But here, he's being called the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. So, you can't be a Bodhisattva and a Buddha at the same time. So, why is he being called a Bodhisattva here? The reason being is that he is appearing to be a Bodhisattva for the benefit of the audience. And it says here he's an Arya. So he's actually appearing as an Arya Bodhisattva, meaning generally it's said that he's appearing as a very high level Bodhisattva, someone who's very close to enlightenment. So he's appearing in this way for the benefit of the audience, to help the audience understand how to progress on the Mahayana path to enlightenment. And so Bodhisattva again, Bodhi means enlightenment, Sattva means courage or strength here. So a Bodhisattva is someone who has the courage or strength to strive for enlightenment. But then we see a second word mentioned here, Mahasattva. So why is Mahasattva here? So again, Sattva means courage or strength, and again, Maha means great. So a Mahasattva is someone who has great courage or strength. And what that means here is a Mahasattva is someone who has great courage or strength in terms of working solely for the benefit of others. Working solely for the benefit of others, meaning someone who has no selfish motivation, is simply working for the benefit of others. So this is being, of course a Bodhisattva does that, but the word Bodhisattva is directly talking about courage or strength striving for enlightenment. So to emphasize the fact that a Bodhisattva is not only has the courage or strength to strive for enlightenment, but also has great courage or strength to help others, we see the word Mahasattva put in there to emphasize that point. So that's what the word Mahasattva means here. So we have the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. So we have then the Buddha of compassion appearing to be a high level Bodhisattva. And it says that Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom. So the word here, he says he looked upon, whereas the Bhagavan was absorbed. Meaning that as a Bodhisattva, or at least appearing as a Bodhisattva, then Avalokiteshvara wasn't absorbed into emptiness, but he was rather contemplating the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom. He was contemplating the practice of emptiness. So he wasn't fully absorbed in, because if a Bodhisattva can't be absorbed in emptiness and then be in the world as well, in contact or aware of what's going on around them. Because as we're going to see, Avalokiteshvara is now going to have a little discussion with Shariputra. So it says here, he beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So here there's a couple of things that are important. First is, what are the five aggregates? What do we mean by empty of inherent nature? And also this word also is quite significant here, so we'll have a look at that shortly. But first I want to look at the five aggregates. What are they? Because the five aggregates is something that comes up a lot in Buddhist teaching. So I think it's important to understand what we mean by the five aggregates.
What do they
mean? Exactly what I'm going to talk about. Yeah. So the five aggregates, the Sanskrit word for aggregate is skanda. Skanda literally means heap or collection. Heap or collection. Now the five aggregates is one way of dividing up all functioning phenomena. But here, and more commonly, when we see the word, the presentation of the five aggregates, we are more commonly talking about how to divide up the person. That the person is also made up of a collection of many things. Five heaps. Now, of course, the person simply can be divided into two, body and mind. So the first aggregate in the five aggregates, when we're talking about this as a basis of the person, is the form aggregate. Which in Sanskrit is rupa. So when we're talking about the five aggregates in terms of the person, we're talking about the body. When we talk about the five aggregates as a way of dividing up all functioning phenomena, then the form aggregate is basically all physical reality. But here, I want to focus mainly on the five aggregates in terms of the basis of the person. So the form aggregate is the body. The other four aggregates together is the mind. Or all mental phenomena, if we're talking about all of our functioning phenomena. Now, the mind, we can divide up the mind in many ways. But here in the five aggregates, when we divide up the mind, is we can divide the mind into two, which is what's called main mind and mental factors. And this is a huge topic in Buddhism, called lo-rig, which is about minds and awarenesses. And this is a way of dividing up the mind in terms of how does the mind function. So in our experiences, then, what we term as main mind is the aspect of the mind that simply experiences the raw entity of the object itself. Whereas the mental factors will fill in the experience, determine what type of experience we have of the object. Now, when we look at mental factors, and this is really Buddhist psychology, we can talk about many, many, many mental factors. But generally in the Buddhist psychology, we divide these mental factors into a list of 51. And in that list of 51, very briefly, 26 of them, more than half, are mental afflictions. Which seems to suggest that how our mind operates, it functions, is actually it's quite dysfunctional. Because we have all these mental afflictions that seem to be involved in many of our experiences. You know, mental afflictions here, of course, is things like anger and jealousy and craving, resentment, belligerence, all of these things. So there is quite an exhaustive list here of 26 of them, which again tends to suggest that in our, how the mind is functioning in our experiences is not in a good way. These 26 mental afflictions, of course, is divided into what's called the 6 root mental afflictions and 20 secondary mental afflictions. Meaning those 20 come out of those 6 root core ones. But those 6 root mental afflictions can be further condensed into the 3 poisons. Ignorance, attachment, and aversion. So all of our mental afflictions are really coming out of these 3. These are the 3 core ones. Again, this is a huge topic and we're not going to go into that here, but this is a very interesting area of study, mind and mental factors, to really understand how our mind is working or how it's not working well, actually. Also in this list of 51, we have 5 mental factors, which are called the 5 omnipresent. Oh, there's, by the way, there's 10 virtuous mental factors. So we have some good things going on. Which is like love and compassion and so forth. But in the list of 51, we have also what's called the 5 omnipresent, which means these are 5 mental factors that are present in every one of our experiences. And I want to focus a little bit on these because some of these are very, well, actually they're all important, but 2 of these in this list get special attention. These other mental factors, of course, may or may not be present in certain experiences. You know, we may have anger or jealousy present in some experiences, but not in others. We may have some compassion present in some experiences and not in others. But here, these 5 are always present in every single experience. And within the list of 5, then there are particularly 2 which get very special attention. The first is is feeling, which in Sanskrit is vedana. Now, with this word feeling in Buddhism, we have to be very careful because normally in our English language, when we say feeling, we think of emotions. But in Buddhist text, when you see the word feeling, it doesn't mean emotion. It's a translation of the Sanskrit word vedana. And feeling is the mental factor that simply experiences things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And we can have those pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences both at a physical and a mental level. So often at the physical level, the word vedana is translated as sensation. At the mental level, it's often translated as feeling. It sort of fits better. But whether you say sensation, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensations, or pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings, we're talking about the same Sanskrit word, just whether it's at a physical or mental level. Now, the reason this gets a lot of attention is, of course, this is often where we start to go wrong in our experiences. Because often, on the basis of our pleasant, unpleasant feelings or sensations, we react to them. With either attachment to the pleasant ones, aversion to the unpleasant ones. So then the whole mess begins. So because of that, then this feeling mental factor is taken out of the list of 51 and presented separately, actually as a second aggregate.
because it's something very crucial. It's very important. So it's actually presented separately. Likewise, in here, there's another mental factor. Often translated as discrimination, and I'll get the Sanskrit spelling correct here, samjha. Samjha. I don't know how to pronounce it well. But this mental factor is, in our experience, is the ability to distinguish one thing from another. Probably something similar to that. Maybe. Probably. Sometimes translators translate this as perception. But again, it's this mental factor, is the simply the ability to distinguish one thing from another. And, of course, if we don't have the ability to clearly identify things correctly, then it's a big mess. So if we don't see things really very clearly, accurately, if we project or don't perceive things in a clear way, we often end up in a big mess. So therefore, this mental factor also is taken out and listed separately as the third aggregate. Then the fourth aggregate is simply all the other mental factors, the other 49 mental factors. Which often is translated as sometimes like compositional factors. The original Sanskrit word there is samskara. Sometimes it's translated as like mental formations, a number of different ways. The reason it's called compositional factors, because here in this list, we are talking about predominantly a lot of these mental afflictions. And so depending on how we respond or react to our experiences is going to determine what our future is going to look like. Hence, these factors, depending on which ones are present in our experiences, are literally composing what our future is going to look like. And so those of you who've done Goenka Vipassana, Goenkaji calls these samskaras the reactive mind. You know, we're reacting to our experiences, and that's going to determine what the future is going to look like. And hence, that's the word compositional factors. So this is all the mental factors together. And then the fifth of the five aggregates is simply the what's left over, the main mind. Which normally is translated here as consciousness or vijnana in Sanskrit. So this is a way of dividing up the mind of the person into these four parts. And again, the reason it's divided up into four is to really highlight that these two mental factors are very crucial and often where we start to go wrong in our experiences. And so one of the reasons that the Buddha often presented these five aggregates in terms of the person was to help break down this grasping onto self. Because when we grasp onto self, we're grasping onto the fact that there's this single, solid, substantial me here. That's how we experience it, as a single, solid thing. But then he says, no, there's no single, solid thing here. There's just a collection of five things, five collections. There's not a single, solid thing here. So often this presentation was given by the Buddha to help break down this false sense of me, this grasping onto this solid me, self. So this is the basis of the person, and also it's a way of breaking up all of reality. But here, mainly, it's talking about in terms of the basis of the person, the body and the mind of the person. So is there any questions about these five aggregates? Anything that's not clear?
Word aggregates.
Yeah, I mean, again, normally in the English language we don't use that word much, but this word skanda just means like heap. And I've heard that apparently when the Buddha was giving this description, he was using rice grains and just putting five heaps of grains down to say that the person is made up of five heaps of things. So sometimes the heaps... Heap means just a heap, a pile.
Okay.
A pile of stuff. A heap is a pile of stuff. So I'm only using this because this seems to be the most common word that's been translated for the last many years. But it just means like an aggregate. The word aggregate means an aggregation, means a collection of things coming together. To aggregate something means we've put together lots of things. So it's like collections. But again, yes, normally in English language, everyday language, you don't really use the word aggregate very much.
It's for only person or sentient being has five
aggregates? So here we're talking in terms of person. Now, the word person, of course, doesn't technically have to just mean human being. In fact, tend to use the word sentient being more than person. Sentient being, again, sentient being is not a common English word, but the word sentient means, in Tibetan, is sem chen. And sem means mind, and chen here means possessing. So a sentient being is anything possessing a mind. Right? So then when we use the word sentient being or person, it's really just anything that possesses a mind. Oh, another one here is contact, meaning that we contact the object. Another one is intention. And the fifth one is, I think, what's called mental engagement, which means the engaging in the object. These are the five that are in every experience. Is that we have contact, feeling, discrimination, intention, and mental engagement. These are always present in every experience.
Can you give the Sanskrit those?
No, I don't have them on me. No. Sorry.
I was just confused about the feeling and discrimination.
Right.
Feelings typically will come through senses.
Not only. No. Because, for example, if you remember something, then you may have a pleasant experience. That's not coming through the senses.
What about discrimination?
The same thing. So these can both be through sensory input or mental input. Yeah. Like I said, we remember some event, and then from that arises a pleasant feeling.
Discrimination
is we remember clearly that event. So discrimination would be to clearly identify that memory, to clearly see that memory.
Actually, the way I'm looking at it is that in our day-to-day experience,
right,
our ability to discriminate between things.
But remember, discrimination here is can be at a very basic level, is simply to recognize that this is a cup. At a very simple level. Of course, discrimination can go more than that, like, this is a beautiful cup, it's my cup. But at the very basic level, at the initial level, is simply to recognize that this is a cup here.
But it's again coming through the visual sense.
That is, but again, if something pops up in our mind, discrimination would be go, oh, that's a memory from an experience I had 5 years ago.
But again, initially created through a visual sense.
Not necessarily.
How else would discrimination arise?
Not necessarily. Like, for example, if I describe to you a place that you've never been, then you get a mental image of that in your mind. You've never experienced that through your senses. But you still have then an image of that, and then you would have a memory of that. So that's something that you have a memory of that you've never experienced through the senses. Another classic example, of course, is subatomic particles. Do you have an idea of subatomic particles? Have you ever experienced a subatomic particle with your senses? No. But you have a concept, you can think about them in your mind.
That's a good
idea. Yeah. Another example, justice. Have you experienced justice with your senses?
But it was explained.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It was through the senses.
Right, but you didn't experience it through the senses. You formed a mental image of it in your mind. So, yeah. Okay, anything else? Yeah. Oh, I haven't listed all the others, sorry. There's what's called the, there's five, what's called the determining mental factors. And included in there are things like mindfulness and wisdom and so forth. And then there are what's called the four changeable factors. And one of those is sleep, another one is investigation. So changeable means they can either become virtuous or non-virtuous. You know, like investigation and analysis are two of the ones there. But again, this is a huge topic that, you know, we can study.
Do the five omnipresent also manifest during the higher jhanas or realization of emptiness or something like that?
Yes. Yes, I think so. I have to think about that, but I think so.
Could you elaborate a bit on consciousness? How does
it Sorry?
Fit into consciousness? How does it fit into mind? How does it
Right. Yeah. So, this is where we get into difficulties with terminology, is particularly these words like mind, consciousness, awareness. And unfortunately, the word awareness, from at least my perspective, is overused in Buddhism. And it's often used by different translators to talk about completely different things. So then there's mass confusion. And also here, the word consciousness and mind, when we speak very generally, they're synonymous. Mind equals consciousness. But here, as we see, consciousness, or what's been translated as consciousness here, is simply one aspect of the mind. It's the what's called the main mind, primary mind. So therefore, we have to be very careful, is that due to the limitations in the English language, we sort of end up in these difficulties where translators use terms in different contexts to mean slightly different things. So that's why it's important when we see these presentations is to try to go back to the original Sanskrit term to try to work out what do we mean by consciousness here. And so here in the five aggregates, consciousness means simply the part of the mind that is responsible for the raw experience of the object itself. And then the other part of the mind in that experience is all the mental factors. So here, consciousness equals mind minus mental factors. Whereas in general, consciousness equals mind.
So where would a thought fit in? Would that be as part of consciousness or part of samskara?
A thought?
A thought.
Again, a thought is, a samskara is the all these mental factors. So a thought is an experience. It has all these mental factors within it. Yeah. So, of course, we can be experiencing a physical object or a mental object. And the mental object could be a thought, a memory, an image, an emotion. So these are mental objects which have these mental factors. And some, of course, not all mental factors are present in every experience.
Okay. So here, just to finish off, and then it's time for lunch, it says that Avalokiteshvara beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So here this term, empty of inherent nature, is emptiness. And inherent nature here can also be translated, or there are a number of different terms which we'll look at, inherent existence, independent existence, many different terms, but we'll look at these different terms shortly. So basically here, this term empty of inherent nature means that he beheld the five aggregates, which means the body and the mind, as empty of independent existence. And the word also here is very significant. Why is the word also here? So what we're saying is here is that Avalokiteshvara saw that the body and the mind also were empty of inherent nature. The word also means not only the person is empty of independent or inherent existence, but the basis of the person, the five aggregates, is also empty of independent existence. That's what the word also implies. And the word also comes a little bit later in the Heart Sutra, and so we're going to talk a little bit more about the significance of that word again more in detail later. So this is the uncommon prologue, is that unique to this sutra, the Buddha was absorbed in emptiness, appearing like that to the audience, but actually he was completely aware of everything that was going on around him. And then also we have nearby, we have Avalokiteshvara, who's appearing as a high-level bodhisattva, and he was also coming to understand that not only the person, but the basis of the person, the body and the mind, are also empty of inherent existence as well. So that is the uncommon setting of this sutra. And then after lunch, we're going to have a look at the actual sutra itself. So let's take a break now, have some lunch, and come back at 2 o'clock.